This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and one of my very favorite guests is back on the show today. Tom Philpott is the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. His book is Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. And boy, will you learn a ton if you read that book. It's basically evergreen. I don't think anything else has come out, anything even remotely like it. Not that it's so old. It came out, in 2020, right, Tom?
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, great. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. I love being able to call you up and say, hey, what's going on, man? Let's talk about your latest story. And your latest story was really interesting to me.
Well, thanks for having me so much, Katie. Let's jump right into it.
So your last story identified, and the nepotistic part of this is almost the least of the story. But anyway, just to kind of give readers a background, Tom just wrote a story about Jess Vilsack, who is the son of Tom Vilsack, our Secretary of Agriculture. Jess has taken on a new job as the general counsel with a company that is called Summit Carbon Solutions. And Summit Carbon Solutions is looking to build a massive pipeline that they are dubbing the Midwest Carbon Express. And this is meant to capture the carbon dioxide emitted by 31 separate ethanol plants that are scattered throughout the Midwest and bury said carbon dioxide in North Dakota. Tom, you're going to have to explain to me how you bury a gas. But anyway, But for starters, take us through a little bit of the history of ethanol in the United States, because I think it's, people see that their gas is a certain percentage of ethanol, but I think it's probably lost somewhat in the distant mists of time why we do this and how that came to be. And also, after you do that, I want you to talk about Secretary Vilsack's role in promoting ethanol and the corn industry in the United States over the last couple of decades. But let's start with the history of ethanol for starters.
Yeah, and I'll try to be really brief. But, basically, it's a product and an industry that would not exist without government support from the very beginning. And I think that the sort of long story short is that when we started to really produce a whole bunch of corn, we see this spike in corn yields in the second half of the 20th century, and this policy push to sort of maximize production, maximize acreage of corn, you get this this overproduction, this sort of structural overproduction, right, and this scramble to find ways to use it.
Right.
You can only use so much of it. It's a great feed for the livestock industry.
Yep.
Livestock industry booms over the same period, partially because corn is so cheap.
Right.
But you can only, feed so much corn to animals. And so the scramble in the 70s, starting in the late 70s and into the 80s, comes like, how can we add value to this cheap corn and make a profit out of it? And the ethanol industry and the high fructose corn industry sort of develop in tandem by Archer Daniels Midland. They figure out a way to create high fructose corn syrup and make it profitable.
Right.
But you get these sales spikes of soda in the summer. It's hotter in the summer. People drink more soda.
Yeah.
The industry burns through more high fructose corn syrup, and their plants that make it, start to idle a little bit, not work at full capacity in the winter. Uh-huh. And so they really start pushing ethanol as something you can mix into the gasoline supply. And they get some couple of different government programs. The first one was a tax break for gasoline mixers. We get a tax break for mixing in ethanol. And then later under George Bush, starting in 2005 and once again bumping up in 2007, you get this ethanol mandate, which says that these gasoline mixers, these, you know, these companies that mix up the gasoline and create our gasoline supply, they have to use a certain amount of ethanol. And the tax break went away around 2010, but the renewable fuel mandate that sort of boosts ethanol remains to this day. In fact, the Biden administration has to decide, I think, later this year.
Yes, I read 2022. Yeah.
Yeah. How to, it's the EPA, not the USDA, has to decide what those levels will be going forward. But right now, the mandate means that about 10% of our, you know, fuel supply in the United States has to have ethanol in it. And so, you know, that's what really boosts this industry up. But without the tax break, you know, for decades, and then the ethanol mandate taking over for it, you know, 15 or so years ago, we would not have a massive ethanol industry. And I think it's worth saying that the ethanol uses about a third of the corn crop. So, you know, you're talking about 80 million acres of corn.
Yeah.
You know, grown every year. That's almost a landmass, almost the size of California. And a third of it is going into our car fuel to offset just 10% of our gasoline use. Right. And so it is a staggering use of resources. And, you know, my book lays out some of the costs of that to the soil in the Midwest and the all of that kind of stuff.
And the water use, because corn is a very water intensive crop. So there's
a lot of the Corn Belt is rain fed. I mean, parts of, you know, parts of the plains, it's a very big issue when you're, you know, sucking dry the Ogallala aquifer for corn. But I think that the bigger water problem for corn is just the water pollution that comes off of these farms. And I'm sure your show has discussed in the past.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. All of the agricultural inputs that go in to make a corn yield as big as it is, end up in the waterways as they run off the fields. Yeah. So yeah, it's all part of the big dead zone down in the Gulf and everything else. I know you've written about that too. I want to go back to something you said though, in the beginning here, which really has puzzled me. And I hadn't really thought that the corn, I really thought of this whole sort of ethanol, you know, bugaboo as something that kind of emerged in the late 90s as kind of, you know, a part of a, you know, a sort of sustainability initiative, if you will, or, the idea that this is somehow going to be healthier for the planet. But in fact, what you're saying is that the corn lobby was, or the corn industry was ramping up even in the 70s and 80s. What drove that? Why did it get to be so big in those preceding decades? Like that I was unaware of.
Well, there, you know, it was, you know, mostly what I was saying before about how we've got to figure out a way, you know, some added value. If corn, I mean, imagine like a bushel of corn goes for between, you know, it gyrates, but as low as $2 a bushel to $5 or $6 a bushel.
Or somewhere nine. Between. I remember in 2012, 13, 14, corn was going as high as $7 and $9 a bushel.
Yes, that's right.
Really incredible, yeah.
The sort of more normal price is around $3.50. A bushel is 66 pounds. And so you're talking about pennies a pound for this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so you got to figure out a way to do something with it and make it worth more. And so that was the original impetus. But you're exactly right that, there was also from the start, there was this energy independence idea. There was this idea that we're importing all this oil from the Middle East and we can do domestic, you know, we can have energy independence and grow domestic fuel, renewable fuel. I think that's a misnomer. I don't think it's renewable at all. It's just the soil impacts of it.
Sounds good though.
But yeah, in the mid-2000s, especially, when you've got high oil prices, you've got, you know, the ill-fated Iraq war venture, and you've got, you know, growing concern about climate change, and you had a president who was very aligned with the oil industry.
Sure.
And he's got to do something. And so that was sort of George W. Bush's big response to climate change concerns about wars for oil. was, okay, we're going to put a lot of resources here into building out our domestic ethanol production. And, you know, a lot of critics like myself think that was a completely false solution.
Yes, totally false for all the reasons that we are going to explore in the rest of this program, but also some of the ones that you just alluded to, which is the impact of corn on soil, on water health, soil health, et cetera. But let's move on for a second and talk a little bit about the Midnight Carbon or Midwest Carbon. I keep wanting to say Midnight Express, right? Midwest Carbon Express. You know, they're supposed to capture all this carbon dioxide from the ethanol plants and so on. First of all, how long is the pipeline? What are they talking about here? How much land will it travel through? How long is it?
It's massive. It's right? It goes through multiple states, mostly Iowa, Minnesota.
Oh, yeah, they're going to love that. Mm-hmm.
Illinois a little bit, mostly Iowa. And it covers, you know, the plan would cover 2,000 miles.
That is big.
And it involves something like 30 ethanol refineries. And, you know, the other thing is also fertilizer plants. I think there's one or two ammonia fertilizer plants in that area uh-huh. that would sign up for it. So it would capture CO2 from these plants, liquefy it, and put it in the pipeline. Now, let me just say something positive about it.
Yes.
And that is that this is really the same idea as clean coal. That talk about a relic from the mid-2000s, this idea of clean coal. The idea was that when you burn the coal, if you could grab the carbon out of it and sequester it, then you would have clean coal.
Right.
That was false for many reasons, because there's a lot more nastiness in the smoke that comes out of coal than just carbon dioxide.
Sure,
but
of course.
The problem with coal burning and carbon capture, the reason why it never took off, is that the smoke is only about, I think it's like 20% carbon dioxide. So it's not a very pure source of carbon dioxide.
Right.
So it ends up being really expensive and energy intensive to sort of purify it and trap it and get pure carbon dioxide. Ethanol is... essentially, an ethanol plant is a distillery. Uh-huh. What it's doing is it's taking corn and fermenting it, just like the process for making beer.
Yep.
And oh my God, hold on one second. I hope we can. I think my partner has left, and the dogs are loose.
dogs happen. I have a dog in this house. Who's likely to erupt. Don't worry about it.
So to go back. The thing about ethanol is basically a distillery. So you're first making beer, and then you're distilling that alcohol into pure alcohol, and that's what ethanol is. And so imagine the carbon dioxide that comes out of beer. It's like this pure thing as part of the fermentation process. And so the stream leaving it is like 98% carbon dioxide.
Oh.
And so in contrast to coal... it's a lot cheaper to trap this carbon.
Right.
And so that's a positive about this. And the same thing is true of, for different reasons, but the same thing is true of fertilizer plants. You get a very, pure stream of CO2 leaving them.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what makes it attractive, is that you can do it for, really low cost. Probably about the last positive thing I'm going to say about this.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. Okay. So in your piece, you write that Summit Carbon Solutions, the company that is proposing this pipeline, their business model relies heavily on federal farm and energy policies that are friendly to big agribusiness, along with the renewable fuel standard that we discussed a few minutes ago that came in under the George W. Bush administration. So let's talk for a second about these agricultural policy, these subsidies and energy policies, and the impact of that they have had on the farm economy, say over the last, I don't know, 15 years. Is that a fair time period to talk about them?
I mean, I think the thing that I had in mind when I wrote that is this thing called Section 45Q of the tax code.
Uh-huh,
And that hasn't had much of an impact yet. And really, a lot of the climate stuff, like I'm sure you've had shows about carbon markets and agriculture.
I think with you.
Yeah, I think I remember that. And And all that stuff is pretty much in its infancy, and it's pretty much a lot of hopes and dreams, and the price is still really low for carbon that's like carbon sequestered in soil.
Right.
45Q is a potential gold mine.
Well, that's okay. The thing. I mean, you described like phenomenal profits to be made. And I wanted to ask you, like, what kind of money are we talking about if this project reaches fruition?
So we're talking about really big money, and it could be a lot more money really soon. And so 45Q is this idea that came up in the late 2000s in the tax code. And it was all about clean coal. And it was all this idea that we'll give you a tax, you know, we'll have a price of, you know, the per ton price of carbon dioxide sequestered in the ground in these, you know, deposits, these underground formations. We'll have a price for it, and that will help you get your clean coal off the ground. Well, it never worked for clean coal because the price would have, it's so expensive, the price would have to be so astronomical that, you know, even sort of govern, you know, even sort of like congressional people sympathetic to the coal lobby, they couldn't get the price high enough to actually help with clean coal.
Okay.
And so it just kind of sat there, and it was very little used. And then in the 2018 tax overhaul by Donald Trump, 45Q got a major boost. I think it was $30 a metric ton. And the 2018 reform takes it up to 50 a metric ton. And so this summit, this Midwest pipeline that we're talking about, it claims that it can sequester 12 million tons of carbon dioxide every year. And so if you multiply that by 50, you get $600 million a year.
Wow.
But there's a couple of things in the horizon that could sweeten that very much. One of them, and the major one, is that the Build Back Better bill has, you know, it sort of gathered up all these really disparate elements, right? Which is how that bill got made in the first place, which is all this different stuff. And one of the things that it hoovered up was taking the 45Q and raising it to $80 a ton.
Whoa.
From 50. And so our calculation of $600 million goes over $1 billion a year. But there's another catch to it. And what it offers is direct pay. I didn't get into this in that piece, but I have another piece that I'm working on.
Right.
It would make it direct pay. So in the old one, a tax credit is only good if you have taxes to pay, right?
Right.
Like if they gave you and me a $50 million tax credit, that would be great, but we don't make enough.
We don't make $100 million.
Yeah. So we would benefit a lot smaller. And so if your project doesn't have any income at all, because you're literally burying something under the ground,
right?
And your only income is going to be stuff like tax credits, then, you know, you have a couple solutions. There's a thing called a tax equity swap, where you can get an investor to essentially invest in your company. And part of what they get for it is they can use that tax credit. And that shaves about 20%. The sort of cost of doing business for that would take about 20% off of that.
Right.
But what the Build Back Better bill would do is make a direct pay. And so what that would mean would be like, you don't have any taxes, don't worry. Your $600 million or $1 billion or whatever it's going to be will be like a tax refund, like you overpaid. And so you would get a check from the government for $1 billion. For indirect pay. And you've probably heard of a certain senator in West Virginia who loves coal named Joe Manchin.
Yes, I have heard of him.
Who has, you know, one of the, you know, two or three votes, who knows how many votes, holding back Build Back Better.
Yes.
He's got various things in it he doesn't like, and so he won't vote for it. But 45Q is one that he likes a lot. And in 2021, I think it was in March, he introduced a bill that would take 45Q to $110 a ton.
Oh, come on.
And so now you're taking that 50 and more than doubling
it. Cut it out.
You know, Jesus. Well over $1 billion a year. And so, you know, when they, if they, if they break Build Back Better into chunks that are mansion friendly, as there's a lot of talk about that, yes, that will definitely happen. I don't know if it'll go all the way to 110, right, but he's very much in favor of an expanded 45Q and direct pay as part of it.
Who's paying the direct pay? Like, is that coming out of our tax dollars?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, because
let me introduce this is unbelievable.
Let me introduce one more minor complication and then drop another shocker on top of it.
Okay. So the
minor complication is there's this thing called advanced oil recovery, and it goes by the acronym EOR.
Uh-huh.
And that is in places where they frack.
Right.
They frack and they get most of the oil or gas out of it.
Right.
But if they inject it with carbon dioxide, they can get another sort of, they can free up another bunch of oil from that well.
Okay.
And advanced oil recovery is something that happens quite a bit when there's high oil prices. When oil prices go up, that oil gets more valuable, so it makes sense to go get it. And you can, under current law, you can get a $35 per ton credit for sequestering carbon while doing advanced oil recovery.
Oh, nice.
And so now your CO, so what your CO2 in this scenario, what your CO2 is going to is, it's going into an oil well and getting this last bit of oil out. And supposedly, if everything works right, it will then be sequestered forever in this deposit. And so you're getting oil on top of this sequestration. And this is really controversial in environmental world about whether this should be, is this a positive thing if we should be subsidizing it? But right now it's subsidized at the rate of $35. So it's $15 less. So you're in, so you look at it and say, well, I get $35 a ton from the government if I do advanced oil recovery, but I get $50 if I don't. So there's $15 difference. So I might as well not do it. But it could be really profitable to do it when oil is high enough. And in my reporting, I learned that the rule of thumb is that EOR, it goes for per ton of carbon dioxide about 40% of the price of a barrel of oil at a given time.
Wow.
And so right now, if this pipeline were up and running, which it's not, they could get way more money if they did advanced oil recovery than if they didn't, because they can get $35 for advanced oil recovery and about $35 for on their 45Q tax break and about $35 more for the EOR part of it, advanced oil recovery. So that would take it to $70 versus $50. There you get $70,
right.
Yeah, and so the incentive would be to do advanced oil recovery. And this is a big, on the ground in Iowa, this is a big sticking point because the activists and environmental groups that are fighting it say this is a backdoor way to do advanced oil recovery with this carbon. This carbon is going into the fracking industry. And Senate says, no, it's not. We have no plans to do that. But I'm here to tell you that the guys behind Summit aren't the kinds of guys that look kindly upon, giving away hundreds of millions of dollars in profit over some principle. So I think it remains an open question. And I think that, as the rate goes up, I think the if it goes to 80, I think that the non-EOR, the EOR rate would be 55, and that's a bigger difference. So it's a bigger difference, and so it raises the threshold over which it's profitable. But under the current law, under current 45Q, it's profitable over $38 a barrel at a time when oil is $80 a barrel.
Right.
So that's just a side note to think about. Is that Summit says, we're not going to do advanced oil recovery with this. But activists, I think, do have a case when they say, you know, what's going to stop you from doing it down the road?
Right. Who's going to stop them? I mean,
so let me just lay quickly one more thing because I got you with that, you know, which just how much money they can make off of 45Q. Well, yeah. There's this other thing that is called the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard. Uh-huh. And it's California's trying to take down the carbon intensity of its auto fuel. And so it's, it basically will issue credits to gasoline. So if you sell a low carbon fuel into that market, they will issue you a credit that you can then sell to a producer of dirtier fuel.
Oh, right.
And that is another big part of this business model. And I was talking to a couple of analysts today.
Wow.
And the price of that could be, and so that's very much in the plans. They talk about it. If you look at Summit Material, they talk about the low carbon fuel standard. That could be even more of a windfall than 45Q. It could generate even more money than 45Q.
Unbelievable.
Now, that money would be split with the ethanol companies. There is some deal, like if you sign up to be part of this pipeline, then part of the deal that you get is some portion of that credit. So this isn't going straight to the bottom line of Summit, but it's another significant source of profit for this enterprise. So they're talking about it being about a $4.5 billion project.
Right.
And they could more than make that up really fast with 45Q and the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard. And a bunch of other states are coming up with them. I think Washington just instituted one. There's a Canadian state that has one.
Wow.
And so this market is booming. And yeah, it's just like, this could be this massive windfall.
Massive, massive. And we'll discuss this in a minute, but you know, it just shows that there is no slowdown in the way we are essentially funding and providing succor to the oil industry moving forward, even as we all, you know, are saying, oh, well, we have to dial back our reliance on fossil fuels. There was one other thing I wanted to ask you about those. How do they measure this shit? And who monitors it? Like how, like when you're talking about a ton of this or, you know, I mean, how are they able to, it just seems to me like who's reporting on this in order to make sure that it's accurate? Like a company can say, I measured, 500 million tons of ethanol here. I mean, of carbon dioxide. Who is going to say no to that? Who's going to say, well, wait a minute. You know, let me look at how you calculated that. Let me make sure those calculations are correct. Is there anybody minding that hen house or is, you know, the fox in there with the hens?
That is a really good question. And I am honestly not sure if it would be Department of Energy or EPA that would ultimately have to certify that.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not a concern. You know, when I've looked at the, you know, sort of like the environmental group pushback to this, That isn't one of the concerns that I've seen be very prominent. And I think one of the reasons is that we know that this process of making ethanol on the scale does release a lot of carbon. And there are already efforts. There are already some things that they do to capture it. So it is
right.
A pretty well-known phenomenon. Like a lot of the soda that is consumed in the United States is sweetened, as everyone knows, with high fructose corn syrup.
Right.
But the carbonation from it comes from the ethanol industry, because I think the number is maybe 20%, or it might be lower, but some portion of the ethanol, of the carbon released by ethanol, is captured and liquefied and sold to the soda industry.
Wow.
It's not more than that because that's just how big the market is. Like the market can't take it all, but they do know how to do this and they do know how to measure it.
Uh-huh.
And there are actually, there's an ADM plant that was a ADM ethanol plant that I believe is in Illinois that was a Department of Energy sort of test case that is sequestering its carbon, but there's no pipeline involved. It's doing it sort of under, you know, near the plant.
Sure.
And it's pretty well, you know, it's pretty well monitored.
Mm-hmm. Thinking in terms of like, I mean, of course, environmentalists maybe would not pay attention to this, but as a taxpayer who's yes. potentially going to be paying, I want to know who is minding the store here.
Yes. And when a tax credit sort of subtly, I mean, a tax credit is really the same. I mean, if it's the Treasury taking less money in than it would, then you as a taxpayer have skin in that game.
I have to make up the difference, exactly. Yeah. Or I am paying directly out of my pocket. One way or the other, I'm getting fleeced. Yeah.
But when they take a tax break and they sort of subtly turn it, well, it's not really, you know, it's not going to be direct pay. Like to go back to our example, like the government says, you know, KDQ for in time, Philpott, we are bestowing upon you a $2 million tax break. And we're like, well, thank you very much. But we can only use a tiny fraction of that. No, we're going to make it direct pay. In other words, we're going to make the rest of it that you overpaid your taxes and refund it to you.
Right.
Then we're very happy and, you know, reconsidering life choices. Do I really need to keep writing this article? This podcast need to come up. but yeah, it's, you know, it's two quite different things.
Yeah. Well, we have to take a short break here for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Tom Philpott. Stay tuned, because boy, this is an eye popper, I gotta say, even for me.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills, combined with the freshest milk available, created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old-world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
All right, so let's talk again, go back to the Midwest Carbon Express. Which on the surface, as you said at the outset, looks like kind of a good idea, right? I mean, we all want to see carbon dioxide sequestered out of the atmosphere. That's what everybody is looking for, you know. But there is a lot more to this story than how much carbon they're going to sequester. And there were some other significant environmental issues that we really haven't touched on at all. And since we're going to have to wrap this up in a little while, like about 10 minutes or less, let's talk about that. Like, for instance, let's start with just the whole eminent domain aspect of it, which I don't really understand how a private company gets to exercise eminent domain over private landholders. So maybe you could start with explaining that.
Okay, this is where we get into my article, the one that's already been published. And that is that this company has a lot of influence in Iowa and at the national level.
Right.
As you said, Jess Vilsack is now the general counsel for the carbon project. And Terry Branstad, the former governor of Iowa, who is in the Trump administration, a very pro-MAGA sort of a fellow.
Yes.
As Trump's...
Ambassador to China.
As Sonny Perdue put it once that I saw him actually in person say, he's over in China selling soybeans. That's exactly what he was doing.
Yep.
So Terry Branstad is sort of like the, you know, PR guy. He's on the payroll. I forget what his exact title is. And so on the ground in Iowa, I don't know how many miles in Iowa itself, but the bulk of the 2,000-mile project is in Iowa. So, you know, more than 1,000 miles in Iowa.
Wow.
And most of it is that it goes through as farmland. It is getting the raspberry from landowners. The company won't say, you know, which landowners are in its path. But there's just all this anecdotal evidence of landowners telling the company to get lost. We didn't like these other pipelines that went through our land, what they did to them. we don't believe your pitch about ethanol, about how it's going to, you know, be good for all of us because it's good for ethanol. And the hell with you. And they're organizing at the county level. Several counties have had their commissioners come out against it. And so there's this thing called the Public Utility Board in Iowa that gets to decide on eminent domain issues. And they, you know, this has not come before them yet. They're still trying to get landowners to agree. Uh-huh. But they have made it clear that they will use eminent domain if they don't get them to agree. And so this is a three-person board and appointed by the governors on these sort of rotating schedules. And one of them was appointed by Branstad, who stopped being governor in 2016 when the Trump administration started. And then the other two were appointed by his successor, Kim Reynolds, the current governor, who is very tight with Branstad.
Yep.
And very tight with the guy behind Summit, who's this guy named Bruce Rastetter, who's considered the kingmaker of Iowa politics, who's given lots of money to both Kim Reynolds and to Branstad, to their campaigns. He's now literally employing Branstad. And so speculation on the ground is that this this pipeline will have no trouble getting through this commission and getting eminent domain status.
Right.
So that's going to be quite a battle. That's going to cause lots of strife. I mean, I actually think that if I were a corn farmer, I would be very suspicious of this too. But I would also be thinking, now look, the electric vehicle is coming. We're already seeing declines in gasoline consumption. That puts downward pressure on ethanol.
Yep.
This is going to make ethanol more profitable. If they can really get this into the California low carbon fuel standard, it'll generate a lot of income to these ethanol plants that they can pass that on to farmers maybe. I would listen to a pitch like that. And that's the pitch the company's making. But so far, you know, and I think that ethanol, you know, if you put $4.5 billion infrastructure into capturing its carbon, and we should say there are two other pipelines under proposal. There is an Archer Daniels Midland one.
Oh, right.
And there's one that's marked that is backed by the, you know, giant financial firm BlackRock. Two very deep pocketed operations.
Absolutely.
I think they're looking at the same economics that we've been discussing and licking their chops and wondering how can we get our paws onto this loot as well. So right. There are three, you know, the Summit one's the biggest by far, but there are three pipelines under consideration. And if you put multi-billion dollars of investment on the ground, that's going to further entrench ethanol and make it harder to unwind. And if I were a corn farmer, you know, looking at my bottom line, I might consider that, you know, in my equation. But and that's exactly the case that that Summit is making.
Yeah.
And so far, from what I can tell, it has been a major bust. Like, no one wants to listen to this.
Really?
No one believes it. You know, they think it's just going to mess up my land. And, you know, there's a lot of complaints about previous pipelines that have gone through and the land above them not being as productive and that kind of thing.
Sure, sure. I mean, I can see all sorts of reasons. And most importantly, it, you know, it prolongs the dependence on fossil fuel use and, you know, this fake industry of ethanol, which I think we didn't discuss the statistic in the beginning, but I think it takes like a gallon and a half of gas to make a gallon of ethanol or something. Isn't there some preposterous equation like that where it's like...
That's highly disputed. There are lots of arguments around that. But I think any sensible researcher who has looked at it would agree that the amount of sort of net energy released generated by the process is very, very modest. It's not dramatically better than gasoline. It's very, very marginally better. And you know, one thing that gets me is that the internal combustion engine is just this incredibly wasteful technology.
Yeah.
Like, you know, some huge a portion of the energy in your, you know, internal combustion car is just sort of wasted as heat. And the electric engine is just a lot more efficient. And so you know, ethanol is sort of keeping us wed to this incredibly wasteful technology, and it really doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, as you say, the electric vehicle is making some strides, and car companies are moving along on those, on that track, in a way that is somewhat encouraging.
Yeah. And there's a lot of government, you know, the same administration, the Biden administration, that's really kind of pushing projects like this is also putting a good amount of resources into electrifying transport. It's kind of a right. contradiction in policy.
Well, I think it's trying to, you know, placate, you know, a variety of stakeholders, essentially,
yes.
right? I mean, and that's what politics comes down to, is making sure that every mouth that is gaping for money, for food, i.e. money, is going to get its little scrap out of government policy. And that's what we're watching unfold in front of us right now. And, you know, we hope that the technology evolves fast enough to make electric vehicles an even better, some other form of fueling travel and transportation. I mean, electric vehicles are not without consequence either.
No way. You're exactly right.
So, yeah, you know, we still have not found the perfect solution, but certainly it's better than emitting more fossil fuels.
Yeah. It's a step up. I don't know if it's enough, but, you know, my research and, you know, the way that I've processed it is that it's a definite step up. I think, you know, for transportation, it's really hard to see how you get to anything like sustainability in a country that has, you know, outside of a couple of cities, you know, pretty much no mass transit to speak of.
No mass transit, absolutely. I mean, I live in rural Rhode Island. And, you know, we have, and my state is not unlike probably every other state in the union, which is that, and even in Providence, our capital city, there's like a bus system. There's not a lot of public transportation. I mean, it's just, it doesn't know what, this country has never really invested in it because the car, you know, the car industry controlled transportation for so long and still does.
Yeah, we did.
Essentially.
You know, we did in the pre-car cities, we have it, but in the post-car cities, like, you know, the Southwest, where I'm from, Austin, Texas. You know, it's I am now out of there and watching this incredible nonstop growth in Austin.
Yeah,
of its population without any growth in its mass transit. It's going, you know, how is that going to work?
Sure, that's right. That's right. Well, we should probably wrap it up there, Tom. Always a joy and a delight, my friend. Tell people how they can learn more about your work, follow you on whatever, you know, all of the appropriate, promote yourself, my friend. That's
yes. You can follow my tweets on NBA basketball and I do it every once in a while. I'm Food Politics at Tom Philpott on Twitter and with two T's at the end. And find me on motherjones.com.
Yep.
And you can find my book at bookshop.org or any other place you get your books.
That's right. So it's called, by the way, Perilous Bounty, for people
Perilous
if you didn't
Bounty.
Catch that at the top of the episode. Tom, thank you so much. It was really fun to talk to you. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Thanks to my sponsors, and we'll see you next week. Appreciate you tuning in. So long for now.
What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.